Now, people who can believe that I was happy on the levee picking cotton, or happy in the mines digging coal, and giving all this away to other people for their wealth, and unable to protect my house, my woman, my children, are people who can believe that I did this out of love for other people, and that I was happy doing it, and that all those songs and dances I learned while I was doing it meant that I was happy, can believe anything.
That's the unmistakable voice of the great James Baldwin. This week on From the Vault, we look at the political life of this remarkable man. Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. James Baldwin was known to the world as the genius behind the literary works Go Tell It on the Mountain, Notes of a Native Son, Giovanni's Room, and The Fire Next Time, among others. His work, whether fiction or nonfiction, brought the realities of life for African Americans in this country to worldwide attention. His responsibility was to be, as he so often prefaced his words at speeches, brutally honest. That honesty made him a leader in the fight for civil rights. His voice was as mesmerizing as Martin's, his ideas as revolutionary as Malcolm's, and yet he fit somewhere in the middle of the two. We are lucky enough here at the Pacifica Radio Archives to have a generous collection of speeches given by him and interviews done with him. This week on From the Vault, we're concentrating on his political life. I'm not going to fill the time with tons of biographical information. I'll give you the main points, but what I want to do most is let Baldwin speak for Baldwin. Included in this week's program is audio from the early 1960s to the late 1960s, basically the period of time when Baldwin went from being a great influential writer to the forefront of the civil rights movement.
To say some very reckless things tonight, and so I want to make it absolutely clear that I am talking for myself. I am not, I might be at other platforms and other occasions, more or less representing this or that organization or this or that committee, but tonight I am talking to you as Jimmy Baldwin, who was born in Harlem 39 years ago, who has a certain responsibility to the people that produced him, that is all of you. And I'm speaking to you, if I may say so, not as an organizer, and not as a Negro leader, and not as a public figure, not as any of those things, but as one of the poets that you produced.
James Baldwin was born in Harlem, New York in 1924, the oldest child of a large family. He never knew his real father, but his mother married a factory worker and storefront preacher whose name Baldwin took. Baldwin once wrote of his father, "As I grew older, he looked like pictures I had seen of African chieftains. He really should have been naked with war paint on and barbaric mementos standing among spears. He could be chilling in the pulpit and indescribably cruel in his personal life. And he was certainly the most bitter man I had ever met." Baldwin grew up extremely poor, but learned to appreciate his family situation later in life.
I come from a very poor family, and there's a vast amount of vitality, which is a very definite virtue, to be found in those circumstances.
By the time James Baldwin became fully immersed in the civil rights struggle, he had written what are considered his great works. It has been said by many that his involvement in the civil rights movement drained him of his imaginative energy. If this is so, then we can muse over what we didn't receive from his creative mind, while comforting ourselves that this country received in return his actions. Here he speaks at Oakland's Castlemont High School in June 1963.
I think the other reason, and perhaps the most important reason, that I'm throwing the suggestions out to you tonight, is that in this country, every black man born in this country until this present moment is born into a country which assures him in as many ways as it can find that he is not worth the dirt he walks on. Every Negro boy and every Negro girl born in this country until this present moment undergoes the agony of trying to find in the body politic, in the body social, outside himself, herself, some image of himself or herself which is not demeaning. Now many, indeed, have survived, and at an incalculable cost. And many more have perished, and are perishing every day. If you tell a child, and do your best to prove to the child, that he is not worth life, it is entirely possible that sooner or later the child begins to believe it.
Baldwin was very outspoken as well about the politicians and the structure in Washington.
There is, my friends, really, a point at which one has to say, I will not choose between the lesser of two evils. There is no such thing as a lesser of two evils. If the political machines in Washington and elsewhere in the nation cannot throw up better material than Mr. Goldwater, Mr. Nixon, Mr. Kennedy, and so on down an extremely dreary line, then perhaps we, the people whom these dreary people are supposed to represent, ought to find a way of being represented. There are some things that I want to talk about, to suggest to you, and that I want to find out what you think, and perhaps we can establish a dialogue, and if we are extremely disciplined and hard-headed, passionate and moral, we might be able even to rock that rock which is called Washington.
My city's bracing for the next killing thing, standing by the bridge and praying for the next Dr. Martin Luther.
I didn't know I was going to talk, really, you know, and I'm not going to talk very long.
Here, Baldwin introduces Dr. Martin Luther King at an event in Los Angeles in 1968 and proceeds to speak off the cuff with no prepared remarks.
The man who we are here to talk to, who will talk to us, that is Martin Luther King. I think it's very important to remember that this moment in 1968 is a kind of culmination of things that began in this country quite a long time ago, and specifically speaking, 1954, with the Supreme Court decision outlawing segregation in the schools, and in 1957, when Martin was thrown that ball in Montgomery, Alabama, when Rosa Parks refused to stand up because her feet hurt. Now, we watched in this 11 years, in this 13 years, depending on the point of view, in this country, a terrible descent. What Rosa Parks was saying in Montgomery in 1956, and what those Negroes were saying when they were marched for 389 days, the country did not want to hear and did not hear. And as time rolled on, and kids, including people like Stokely Carmichael, were being beaten with chains, thrown into jail, marching up and down those dusty highways.
trying to change the conscience of this country. Still nobody heard, and nobody really cared. And poor Martin spent most of his time in and out of jail, as all of us know, trying to redeem what we claim we live by, the principle of love your neighbor, the principle of if it happens to you, it's happening to me. The principle John Donne talked about, you know, when he said that any man's death diminishes me. But in this country, race and Christianity and power are so tied together in self-interest, what one takes is self-interest, that no one heard it. It's only now that people are beginning to suspect that something terrifying has happened, and with our consent, because we do know that we cannot fight a civil war, which is what this ferment is about, because I am your brother. I was born here. My father's and my father's blood is in this soil, and nothing will drive me from this country. It also belongs to me. You cannot fight a civil war and a global war, too, at the same time, and especially if both are predicated on the same principle. And I'm not now accusing the Americans of being wicked. I'm accusing us of having allowed ourselves to be brainwashed into a state of ignorance which allows us to forget that the peasant in Saigon and the peasant in Detroit are the same people. And what we don't know about the peasant in Saigon is what we don't know about Sambo here. And that has destroyed the American sense of reality. And I suppose what we're here to do tonight is begin to correct that. Any Negro alive in this country, no matter who he is, I mean, from a narcotics addict, from the lowest of the low, even to the most hypocritical of the most hypocritical, knows more about who he is than his white counterpart does. The conditions imposed by the American Republic on the Negro have made it necessary, imperative, that he not fool himself about that. He may be destroyed by it. Is that the same thing? I was born knowing, having to know, by the time I was 5, that life was going to be hard and that I was going to die. White Americans discover this when they're about 30 and then they go to a psychiatrist.
Down in the valley, and the valley so low, pull your head out the window and hear the wind blow. Hear the wind blow. Hear the wind blow. Pull your head out the window and hear the wind blow. Judge, he will sentence you. Clerk will write it down. Tell all your friends that you are jailhouse bound. Jailhouse bound. You're jailhouse bound. Tell all your friends that you're jailhouse bound. Write me a letter, send it by mail. Dress it all over that Birmingham jail. That Birmingham jail. That Birmingham jail. Dress it all over that Birmingham jail. Roses is red and the violets are blue. Angels in heaven singing, I love you.
In September 1963, Less than a month after the March on Washington, 6 children died in Birmingham, Alabama. 4 little girls were killed in the infamous church bombing there, and 2 young boys later that day. This event proved to be a turning point in James Baldwin's political activism. From that point on, he became much more vehement in his speech, in his activities, and even in his views. He swayed briefly from nonviolence to considering a new way. As you listen to this next clip, recorded only 10 days after the tragedy in Birmingham, listen to the difference in Baldwin's voice. The anger, the rage, is palpable.
We are not, are we, at the mercy of our political institutions? If we created them, we are responsible for them. We have the right and the duty to overhaul them, to change them. We are not always so helpless that Senator Easton has to stay there forever. Who said so? I dare them to go in any Birmingham barber shop and talk to anybody. I dare them. And I think that commission, the appointment of that commission, the very notion, and the apathy with which the country has greeted it, proves my point. We have no right to allow the death of 6 children and our common disaster and our common crisis and our moral crisis to be met in this way. It proves, if anything does, that the terms of negotiation must now be radically changed. One cannot negotiate with the representatives of one's oppressor. It is time to let the nation know that the death of my child, I as a black man, and the spiritual death of your child, you as a white man, cannot be met by sending down a commission to find out what happened. We know what happened. What we have to do is prevent it from happening again. And in order to do that, one doesn't beg the Birmingham City Fathers for a truce. You use whatever weight you have to force them to recognize your presence in that city, in that state, and in this country as a man. No matter what it cost who.
He then lets his anger go for a moment and begins to explain what he believed as the only way life in the United States between blacks and whites could change.
Is that we in this country, black and white, do have in our hands at this moment an enormous and expensive opportunity. If we can think through our situation, if we can face it, we can do something which has not been done in the history of the world before. The terms of our revolution, the American Revolution, the terms of these, not that I drive you out or that you drive me out, but that we come together and embrace and learn to live together. That is the only way that we can have achieved the American Revolution. Now, if we can face this, and it involves facing a great many things, it demands that white people face the fact that I, for example, or any black person they will ever meet or have ever met, I'm not an exotic rarity, I'm not a stranger, I'm none of those things. On the contrary, for all you know, I might be your uncle, your brother, your cousin, among other things. One of the things that has happened here, and the pathology of the Deep South proves it, so does the pathology of the North, which dictates to them that they move out when I move in. Among other things which have to be excavated here is the fact that this long history is also the history of a love affair. One has got to face this. I'm no longer really black. Maybe I would like to be. Maybe I'd like to go back to Sierra Leone, for example. That was where I came from. But I've been here a long, 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 long time. And I'm now a part of you. And you are a part of me. And the conditions of our maturity, which is our survival, is that we accept this fact and rejoice in it. If we could do that, we might open up and by the example of our own lives and bodies, a possibility that in the future, mankind all over the world will not find it necessary to blow each other up in order to settle a quarrel. Thank you.
I apologize for the quality of the tape at the end there, but please understand this audio was taken from a reel-to-reel tape first recorded on 43 years ago. The Pacifica Radio Archive exists in order to preserve reels like this one. This program, From the Vault, helps the archive to restore reels that are in much worse shape than this one. The beauty of James Baldwin is so complex. His wonderful imagination, his ability to lay down beautiful prose on paper, his oration. Basically, he was a wonderful communicator in all forms. He often spoke to young people at high schools and colleges, and after a speech he gave at Oakland's Castlemont High School in June of 1963, Baldwin was asked a question by one of the students. The student asked Baldwin why did he, quote, write in the fire next time that it is harder for whites to accept blacks than blacks to accept whites.
The reason it's hard is because one has been, and this is not the fault of any white, one white person that one is likely to meet, but the white culture has operated and has operated deliberately to demoralize all black people. And the demoralization has in many cases been fatal, and in all cases has been sinister. The effort, therefore, that I must make to arrive at my identity is mainly in opposition to the white force of the world. Under such a tension, it becomes very difficult. And then, under such a tension, I must repeat, it becomes absolutely necessary to deal with people as people, only as people. Because you cannot spend your life, this is my point, trying to be revenged for historical crimes. If you do that, you will destroy yourself and you will perpetuate the crime. The thing to aim at, this is why it is a terrible necessity to accept white people, but it's a terrible necessity on the part of white people, even harder necessity to accept Negroes, because in order for white people to accept a Negro, they've got to accept their history and something much deeper and worse than that. They got to accept, if I may now be brutal and rude, but I mean this and you must think about it. If you remember that everything that you will do all your life and everything that you will say reveals you, what I call you doesn't say anything about you, or very rarely, but what I call you says everything about me. Now, there is a very good reason, which has nothing to do with Negroes, why white people call them nigger. It's a white invention. And in order for white people to be released from this invention, they will have to discover where this nigger really lives. And he lives inside white people. And they have to accept him, that stranger within, before they can accept anybody without. That is what I was trying to say.
James Baldwin spent the last 20 years of his life living in Paris, a city he came to know and love when he moved there in 1948. He once said he had to leave the United States again for good in order to, quote, save myself. I loved Medgar, I loved Malcolm, and I loved Martin, and now they are all dead. When you think about it, it is incredible. I'm the last witness. Everybody else is dead. I couldn't stay in America. I had to leave.
All I know about my own life, for example, is that I've been scared to death for 39 years and 6 months. And all I know about fear is that if you're afraid of it, walk toward it.
Sonorous angel, the Norris Jones Road drone angel, the very deep alone zone angel, angel. Ringing, singing, tossing, turning, like the four taps.
In Saint Paul de Vence, France, on the French Riviera, James Baldwin died of stomach cancer in late 1987. He was 63.
I don't want to see any more blood. Nobody's blood. My God. No, if we could end the nightmare tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, I could die, you know, in peace.
To the rescue, to the rescue. James Bond went to the rescue, to the rescue. Again and again and again.
They came here to make, as we like to say, a better life for themselves and their children. And as it turned out, and as it always does indeed turn out, what they meant by a better life for themselves and their children was the opportunity to make more money and oppress somebody else, which is what they did. The Indians had vanished, except for those we have under protective custody. And in order to build the country, it was necessary to find a source of cheap labor. And therefore, 400 years later, I represent the only man who never wanted to come here.
That does it for another week of From the Vault Remixed. From the Vault is a weekly program produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, and the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica Station listeners.